joining our Facebook page. And that's it for Stage and Studio today. Thanks for joining us, Jane. Jane's already left. Thanks to engineer Judy Feastall. Till next week, I'm James Dixon with Stage and Studio. Thanks for listening.
Cable with the Clinton is our monthly film series at the Clinton Street Theater. This month we're celebrating Fat Tuesday on Tuesday, February 28th, with the Les Blank films, Always for Pleasure and Dry Wood. Les Blank sat at the kitchens and on the porches of Creole folk in the Delta to capture their Mardi Gras spirit and traditions to make the film Dry Wood. Les filmed Always for Pleasure, documenting the 1970s carnival celebrations in New Orleans. Again, that's a night of films by Les Blank to celebrate Fat Tuesday, February 28th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Andy Warhol looks at screen, hang him on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver screen, can't tell them apart at all.
My name's Joseph Gallivan, and you're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is Judith Sobel. She's the executive director of the Iris and B. Gerald Kanter Foundation, and she's here to talk about Rodin, the Human Experience. That show is at the Portland Art Museum from January 21st through April 16th. Thanks for coming to KBOO, Judith.
My pleasure.
This is a collection of Rodin pieces. Bronze is 75, maybe?
52. It's taken from a collection of about 200 because we were able to borrow not only from our own collection, that of the foundation, but also from the private collection of Iris Kantor.
Mm-hmm. When you go in, one of the first things you see is a smaller version of Rodin's Gates of Hell, which were to illustrate from Dante's Inferno. Just tell us, what is this small version and where is the original big one? Is there one?
We have in the exhibition a bronze cast of one of the sketches in clay that Rodin made on his way to achieving his final conception of what the gates of hell would look like. And the gates of hell was to be a pair of doors for a new museum in Paris that was to be built in the 1880s. So they're door-like. They look like the doors to a medieval cathedral, for instance. Mm-hmm. Because of the way in which bronzes are made, that is, they are multiple originals. There are many casts of this particular piece at many different sizes, because there were machines in Rodin's day, just as there are today, that the sculptor can say, I like this, but I want it larger, or I want this smaller, or a patron can come in and look at one and say, that's wonderful, I want it, but I can't afford one that big. Can you make one smaller for me? Mm-hmm. So when you look at Rodin, sometimes you will say to yourself, oh, I know that piece, but I remember it is so much bigger. And as a matter of fact, your memory is correct because mm-hmm. you saw it bigger. The closest large scale, that is, to size that it was meant to be by Rodin when it was finished, is at Stanford University in the Kanter Sculpture Garden, a gift from the foundation to the Art Museum at Stanford.
Mm-hmm. So the idea was to decorate or to make the doors for an art museum, which never got built, and instead they built the Orsay train station, mm-hmm. which now is an art museum. Was this one of his great works, but it never kind of got executed?
Well, it was his first major commission. And it was, in those days, if you were to do something that was deemed important, a public commission would be much more important than a private commission. So when the French government, through one of its officials, came to Rodin and said, we want you to do the doors for this to-be-built museum, Rodin was ecstatic because he knew it would make his career. When the commission, in effect, was canceled, because, as you said, they used the site for a train station, because of the design that Rodin had conceived, he was able to take huge hunks, figures, off the doors and to use them as independent sculptures. And so the show includes some of those pieces, not only this sculpted sketch, which is called a maquette, but also some of these independent pieces that he then renamed so that they would be more marketable and of more general interest.
Right next to it then is one of them. It's called Three Shades, three ghostly men naked, standing, and they've all got their heads tipped down at a sort of 90-degree angle to their necks. And what did he do with some of the elements of this?
First of all, as it was originally conceived, it was to stand atop the gates of hell. And they were pointing to an inscription, quoting Dante, saying, "Be wary, all ye who enter here." So that's why their necks are bent. But this particular conception of the shade, which shows so much Rodin's interest in Michelangelo, then became a source for him to make additional pieces, like right next to it in the exhibition is the head of a shade where the head is upright. And it has a completely different feeling when you look at it. You don't get the sense of melancholy and overt tiredness that you do with the three shades. You get instead a more alert, more erect, more interested in the world person. And although it's a head of a shade, the only evidence that you have is that it's warning you about the gates of hell is the title, not the look.
Did he remake it by hand, by clay, or did he copy it and, you know, with a machine and recast it?
Well, the issue of bronze casting is fascinating because between the artist actually working a piece of clay into something figurative, in Rodin's case, and the cast coming out of the foundry, there are a number of steps whereby you are left with pieces of casts, and those pieces of casts can be reused on different new sculptures. So there are lots of heads of the shade involved in other Rodin pieces. There are other arms and legs of a shade involved in other Rodin pieces that had that were not done in the 1880s and were not done with the specific intention of reminding people of the three shades. They were just completely reused in such an inventive way that Rodin scholars are still finding new connections between them.
Did he have final say on everything that we see in the show? Or have other people taken his work and put it together?
In the very traditional sense, he was a very traditional artist with a studio of up to 50 people. He did the clay. Sometimes he supervised the making of the plaster cast from then on, and then he gave the finished conception to his working assistants. They were the ones who made the final plaster casts, chose the foundries. There were about 40 foundries working in Paris at the time. Chose the foundry, took the piece to the foundry, said to the founders, "Monsieur Rodin would like you to make a dozen of these at this size. Please sell them and send him the money." And it's unlikely he ever saw them after that. He was really, he was an artist in the sense that we don't conceive of an artist today. His work was done when he stopped touching it.
That's amazing. So he didn't have a gallery. The foundry were responsible for marketing the work?
Well, he also had a gallery, but the gallery was used where people would come to the gallery and say, they would see a, perhaps they saw a portrait head of an important person like Victor Hugo in a friend's home. And they would come to Rodin and say, "We'd like another one of those portrait heads." So then his assistant would go back to the foundry and say, "Make us another one. Make it for Monsieur Rousseau and send it to him and give us the money." Mm-hmm. So it was a, Rodin was an extraordinary business person and marketing person for his own work. His goal was to be independently comfortable in terms of wealth, but to, more importantly, be the most famous artist of his day.
Really?
He was
he had a big ego?
He was the Jeff Koons of his day. Yeah, indeed. And by the time he was 60, he had achieved that. And the reason, Joseph, why many people think he achieved it was because he was able to do these multiple originals. So it wasn't just one painting that hung in one person's home. It was, in the case of The Kiss, he made 328 of them during his lifetime.
Really?
And they were all over not only Europe and America, but also Japan. He was a big deal.
Everyone knows him as this very expressive clay worker who captured, you know, the psychology of the subject, mm-hmm. as well as the physical appearance, incredible musculature, you know, sort of very anatomically accurate and heroic. There's a piece called Walking Man. It's a torso, and it was, the date was he made it in 1905. The one we have here is 1985. Just tell us a bit about how that got made in 1985.
Yeah.
And also, what is the significance of the actual artist expression of the Walking Man? It's very fragmentary. It's, you know, he was making ruined sculptures from scratch, basically.
Okay. Let's start with a more interesting question, which is the piece. During the time that Rodin was working, there were tremendous interest in archaeological remains being dug up all over Europe. So he saw these fragments of classical sculpture coming out of the ground with broken off arms and legs and heads and accretions on the body as a result of the burial of the piece. And he realized that this piece still had the capacity to move him, although it did not have what we would call all its body parts. And so for him, it was the mystery of how much you could pare down a work, a figure, and it would still give you some emotional communication that was worthy of being a piece of sculpture. So when he started to work with fragments, that throughout the show there are lots of different fragments that he believed would be finished pieces of sculpture. One of my favorite quotes from Rodin is when people exclaimed, "Oh, but it's not finished," he said, "And the cathedrals, are they ever done?" So he was working in the sense of moving the traditions of sculpture past the necessity to be descriptive and instead into what we would call modern sculpture, which is expressive.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in terms of the two dates on the piece, when Rodin died, he made a deal with the French government, and he said he would give them everything left in his studio, which were lots of plasters, these casts, as well as the permission to continue to cast his work after he died in order to fund a museum to guard his legacy. This is legally in line with French law. The French government approved it. And as we've just talked about, he never looked at a piece after it came out of the foundry when he was alive. So this really doesn't in any way deviate too far from his practice as a living artist. So now the Musée Rodin in Paris is the official authorized posthumous castor of Rodin's sculpture, and they carefully guard who can cast pieces, how they're numbered, and how many are made. There's a person on their staff, an attorney, whose entire job is to take people to court who make unauthorized casts.
With someone like the cantors, these collectors, do they get special permission? Or?
No, they just purchased them from the Musée Rodin.
Oh, you
over
can,
60
yeah,
years. Oh, you can do it now. You can go online to the Musée Rodin. You can see what's available. They only make, the French Parliament limited the number that could be made I think in the 1960s to 12 authorized posthumous casts. And if all of these 12 haven't been already purchased, then you can buy one.
That's amazing. Well, what's the market rate for a hand?
A little hand, like a 4-inch hand?
Yeah.
You could get for under 20,000. You can carry it around with you, your sock all day if you want.
He was the master of hands. I mean, people say that an artist who can't draw hands is, you know, not very good artist. But he was just incredible. I mean, surgeons have studied his hand, the hands he has sculpted. What do you know what it is about them?
Well, I think very early on he started to equate the making of art with the making of the world. The notion of the artist as creator was something that we see running throughout his body of work. And he often will make the allusion, frankly, to himself as God the creator. In the exhibition, there's a wonderful plaque called The Creator, which was actually made for the Gates of Hell. And it shows a gentleman with a beard sitting, and above him is a muse whispering in his ear. And the guy with the beard, who's obviously the artist, is Rodin. It's a self-portrait. So over and over again, the hand, which makes the art, is important to him as the creator. And then I think he found the hand as probably, when we talk about the use of the fragments and how they can still be emotive, how small can a piece of the body, how minimal can it be before it loses its capacity to move you? It's probably the hand. He still puts so much into the hand. He rarely got, his pieces never got more reduced than the hand.
My name is Joseph Gallivan. You're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is Judith Sobel. She's the executive director of the Iris and B. Gerald Cantor Foundation. And she's talking about Rodin, the human experience. The show is on now at the Portland Art Museum through April 16th. There is an amazing piece called Iris, Messenger of the Gods. It's a leaping pose. It's a woman's torso with legs and arms, right? She's naked and she's holding her right foot in her hand, kind of like a yoga pose. What is it? Is she dancing? Is she jumping? Or what?
Actually, it's probably a can-can dancer pose. Rodin engaged the services of many dancers as his models. He loved not only the risqueness of the can-can dance, but he also spent a lot of time observing Near Eastern dancers who would tour in France. What he was interested in was not the dance itself, but how the body looked as it moved. Late in his career, he did a whole series of dancers with various poses, which he really just hoarded to himself. He didn't sell them or recast them for others while he was still living. But the Iris Messenger of the Gods is this amazing, exuberant, and very sexual piece, because as she swings her leg open to exude the energy of the dance, you see her genitalia. And somebody said that if she were lying down in a typical model's pose, it would be enormously risque, but now because he's tipped it back and over and upright, it's a completely different sense of the figure. Mm-hmm. It's one of my favorite pieces because Rodin lived at a time of the advent of the motion picture and of the advent of the automobile. And he was crazy about modern life. And he used the examples of the motion picture and the automobile as a way of informing his own work with movement. So earlier you mentioned the walking man, the torso of the walking man. You get a sense when you look at that torso, which incidentally doesn't have legs, you get a sense indeed that the body itself is moving and changing. In many of his works, if you tried to hold the pose with your own feet, you would find that you'll probably fall over because it is showing the figure in three stages of moving. A minute before, a minute now, and a minute after. Mm. It's the sense of making sculpture into something that you cannot reasonably make unless you try something new.
Mm-hmm. Right. So was he working for movie stills?
Not for movie stills. He took a lot of photographs, and he engaged photographers to take pictures for him, and he also worked directly from models. He never, as far as I know, worked from his memory. There was always some model in front of him that he worked from.
Mm-hmm. How does he compare to Degas for his attitude to dancers?
Degas was really interested in the life of the dancer. Rodin is more interested in the body of the dancer.
And the body in motion, really. There is a piece, St. John the Baptist, where, again, to look at it, you couldn't do that in real life. You know, it's a moment in time. Is that one of his innovations, then?
Yeah, he showed the sculptors who came after him that it was not necessary to stick to what you could see. In many respects, he is an inheritor of the freedom of the post-impressionist painters. But he certainly, although he was a friend of theirs, he was not what we would call a post-impressionist. He sat on his own seat high above the sculptors of his day, but he tried to understand the difference between what you see and what you know. And he said, what you know is more interesting and more important than what you can see. St. John got him into a lot of trouble because most traditional sculptures about St. John show him in a hair shirt with the typical attributes of the saint. Whereas in this case, this is a very muscular, very hard-working body that nobody believed should be shown naked as St. John. Mm-hmm. So it pressed forward into the 20th century and the ability to revise a more traditional standard.
Mm-hmm. He did a lot of work in classical subject matter, you know, things from Ovid and Greek mythology, but he also did common people and he did normal looking bodies. So the big Balzac, there's one with Balzac clothed and one with him naked. And the Balzac has got a middle-aged man's body. He's got a pot belly. And what was the effect then of seeing a naked man who didn't look like a cuirass, you know? What did the public think? What did the Academy think?
Well, again, that was a study on the way to a final piece. So it was not necessarily as well-known in its day as it's become in ours, as
That was not made for public consumption?
Not at that point. No, Rodin's way of working was to first sculpt the body nude and to try to get as much expression in that as he could. And he worked from whatever knowledge he had. Well, Balzac was already dead by the time Rodin was doing this. There were a few photographic portraits of him available because photography was in its infancy during Balzac's life.
Mm-hmm. Lived from 1799 to 1850.
Yeah.
So those photos must have been fuzzy
and rare, yeah. And there were some portraits, but they were not terribly descriptive. So Rodin went to Balzac's tailor, and he asked him to make a suit, Balzac's suit for him, so he could see how big the writer's girth was. And then he went to someone from Balzac's town and tried to find someone who looked like the evidence showed Balzac would have looked, and then he used him as his model.
Really? You mean a relative or just someone who lived his lifestyle?
I think, you know, certain areas you can say, oh, these people, particularly in Europe in those days, mm-hmm. there were looks that people had depending on what section of the country they lived in. And then after he sculpted the nude body, then he would sculpt it with clothes on it. And he tried to then convey the expression he'd gotten in the nude body with the sculpted body with clothes on it, and then he would come up with his final conception for the figure. Mm-hmm. So the final figure of Balzac shows him in a huge, heavy cloak and you really don't see the body underneath at all, but you get a sense of the girth. Mm-hmm. He also did pieces of Balzac that didn't show him as he was with all of his appetites apparent, but instead showed him more as a lean, muscular athlete.
Was he doing Balzac because it was like doing the biggest writer of the day? Like it was a celebrity kind of thing?
He got a commission. The best thing you could do if you were an artist was to get a public commission. It was like our Percent for Art program today. There were committees set up. People would send out RFPs for the sculpture. People would they would submit proposals, and then someone would be selected. So this mm-hmm. was a commission from the Society of Men of Letters for a public square in Paris. Paris was rebuilding after the Franco-Prussian War, so there were lots of sculptural commissions available. And this was the one that he got. But they hated it. When it was done, they hated it because it didn't show Balzac in a traditional pose, just as St. John hadn't.
Were they expecting a guy at a desk?
Uh-huh. They were expecting someone with books and maybe a quill and someone who looked like an artistic writer rather than the finished piece. There's one outside the entrance of the Los Angeles County Museum of Art. The finished piece shows him as a very interior person without much experience or interest in the outside world, which we all know is very different from what his writing was.
Mm-hmm. But it was commissioned, they wanted one statue. They didn't think it was going to end up at LACMA in 100 years' time.
In those days, if you commissioned a bronze, if you were in the world, you knew that replicas of it would be made.
Okay. Right.
Sometimes a patron would commission something from Rodin, and he would say to Rodin, but I want this to be the only one. I don't want to go to my friend's house and to see another one of it. And Rodin would say, yes, that will be fine. This will be the only one. And as soon as that was made and sold, he made more.
It's like pirating a movie online. Like, why would he do that?
Because he believed the work of art was his. The person who happened to own the sculpture was a temporary guardian. Mm-hmm. And that he had the right, as the creator of the work of art, to do with it what he wanted.
Mm-hmm. Would you say he's central to our kind of 20th century notion of the artist as a creator, as a sort of individual who funnels everything through them and creates? Because it sounds like he also, you know, a studio of 50 people, and he had a lot else going on.
In the studio of 50 people was probably the end of that tradition. We when we think of an early 20th century artist, we think of La Boheme, the artist starving in his garret. And the people who did their own casting, who did their own making of plaster casts, who did their own frame making if they were painters, these people did it only because they were poor, not because that was expected of the artist. Yeah. Rodin was not poor. By the time he was 60, he rented a wonderful apartment in the center of Paris, which is now the home of the Musée Rodin, and that was his office and studio and showroom. And then he rented in a suburb of Paris, also now part of the Musée Rodin, a home for his partner, Rose Buret, who had been his model, and for his friends to come and visit him. He had a huge studio there, and that's where he's buried. So he had the means to live the life he wanted, and he certainly had fame. You mentioned something earlier about the classical subject matter and all. When Rodin would make pieces, he would often change the titles on them. So whereas at one point one piece might be called Apollo, at another point it might be called Torso with Outstretched Hands. So Rodin's scholarship is very interesting because you never know exactly what the books are telling you. It's endless territory for PhD dissertations.
Well, don't let that put you off, listeners. It is a wonderful show. It's beautiful. It's very clean, and you can really focus on the work. My name is Joseph Gallivan. You've been listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week was Judith Sobel. She was talking about Rodin, the human experience, and the show runs from January 21st through April 16th. Thanks very much for coming to KBOO, Judith.
Thank you.
Andy Warhol looks at screen. Hang him on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver screen. Can't tell them apart at all.
Good morning. Art Focus was made possible in part by you, KBOO Foundation members, and a grant from Portland Saturday Market, From Our Hands to Yours, celebrating 44 years of America arts and crafts, freshly prepared foods with an international flavor, and local music every Saturday and Sunday from March through Christmas Eve in Waterfront Park. Local artisans, international food, live music, PortlandSaturdayMarket.com. You are listening to KBOO Portland. Hey, KBOO listeners, ever wonder what happens to your Fred Meyer reward points? Now you can turn them into excellent community radio by linking your Fred Meyer rewards card to KBOO. Look up KBOO or our ID number 86634 at fredmeyer.com/community rewards. Every time you use your card, KBOO will get money. Your rebates, discounts, and gas bonuses are unaffected. With your Fred Meyer reward card, you can even turn cat litter into support for KBOO. Go to fredmeyer.com/community rewards, all one word, and link your card to KBOO. Coming